Welcome to Utah Week in Review, a new way to process the week's local headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and lots of news to get to. Activists, including a handful of prominent Utah conservatives, fly to Washington to nudge lawmakers to act on immigration reform. So how did Utah's congressional delegation respond? Also, some records in the probe of Utah Attorney General John Swallow have gone missing. House investigators want to know what's up. And state liquor commissioners finally approve new guidelines for serving drinks in restaurants. How will the new rules affect restaurant owners and the dining public? Plus, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby explains his latest column on wanting to be a Relief Society president is not the first time he's attended the Mormon Church all-women's meeting. All that and your calls coming up on the maiden voyage of Utah Week in Review. Stay tuned after the news. Welcome to the premier broadcast of Utah Week in Review. I'm your host, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and the conceit of the next hour is to offer a fresh way to process the week's local headlines. For journalists, Utah is an absolutely fascinating place to cover the news. Each week, a panel of the state's top reporters will join me with details and analysis on the top stories swirling around this pretty great state, and all that plus Trib columnist Robert Kirby later in the show. So, news junkies, you found a new home on Friday mornings here on KCPW, and you are invited to be part of the discussion. You can join us by sending your questions to the hashtag UTReview on Twitter and Google+. You can also put them in the comment section of our page at sltrib.com, or give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. On today's panel, Tribune Washington correspondent Matt Canham joins us by phone from his office in Washington. Matt, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Also with us here in studio, Trib reporter Kathy Stevenson. Kathy, good morning.
Hello.
And Trib political columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
On the agenda today, immigration, liquor laws, John Swallow, Martin McNeil, and anything newsworthy you want to talk about. Again, if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Put your comments at sltrib.com or send us a tweet, UTReview. On Twitter and Google+. Matt, I'm going to start with you. Let's start with immigration. I understand that a number of Utahns went to Washington this week to push for reform. Who went and what was on their agenda?
So we had a group of Utahns that joined in a national fly-in, is what they called it. And what made this one interesting is it wasn't just immigration activists. It wasn't a group of liberals. It was a group of rather conservative people, people like Stan Lockhart, the former state Republican chairman, or Randy Parker of the Utah Farm Bureau, or Donna Milakovich from the Utah Valley Chamber of Commerce. These people want Congress to pass immigration reform or some sort of immigration reform now. But they ran into the same restrictions and frustrations that have plagued this issue since George W. Bush tried to do this in the mid-2000s. What's hanging over this thing is, what do you do with the people who are already here illegally? And the Democrats believe that they've crafted a 13-year path to citizenship that they say is not amnesty. But people like Representative Jason Chaffetz aren't buying it. He's not in support of what the Senate has already passed. And so immigration reform is stymied in the House of Representatives. So these conservatives flew back to Washington to press their fellow Republicans, saying, time to act is now. The House right now seems to have a plan to drag their feet on this. They don't want to do anything for the rest of this year. They're thinking maybe January, maybe February, they start moving on individual pieces of immigration reform, starting with the border security bill, then maybe something on visas, overstays, and taking the issue one by one. The problem with doing that is the political calendar. You have an election next year, and it is common knowledge that the Congress does not like to take big, controversial issues when election day is approaching. So I would say it's unlikely that immigration reform is going to go forward, even when you have such support from both sides of the aisle.
Mm. Paul Raleigh, how does immigration play here locally? Of course, we have some activists who have gone to Washington this week. What about here on the ground in Utah?
Well, it's interesting. Stan Lockhart was one of the people taking the lead on this.
His wife, Becky Lockhart, of course, is the Speaker of the House.
Sure.
And one of their closest, one of their closest friends is Senator Kurt Bramble. And Bramble and Becky Lockhart helped push through a Utah bill a few years ago that included a worker permit for people here illegally. It was very controversial in the legislature, but they have taken a lead on this. And of course, you know, immigration is a federal issue, but the idea was if the state, because the Congress hasn't done anything for so many years, they wanted to do a state resolution and try and push Congress into doing something, force them into it. Bramble is one of the leaders in the country among state legislators through his role at the National Conference of State Legislators, and he's worked on the other side of the aisle with Democrats to try and put together some plans. Becky Lockhart got a lot of, and so did Bramble, got a lot of heat from their own party in Utah County, where they're both from, because of their push on immigration reform. But it's all part, you know, they're tied into the common Utah, I can't remember the name of it, a lot of people signed off on too. For immigration reform and the
Utah Compact?
Yeah, the Utah Compact, thanks. And the LDS Church gave its tacit blessing to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing. Bramble is well known as a kind of a conduit for the church when it comes to legislation and policies they want to push. It's interesting that Utah has taken kind of a lead on this, and other states have looked at Utah. It makes sense that Stan Lockhart would be one of the people leading the way.
Stan Lockhart, of course, a lobbyist for Micron, so he's sort of representing that tech sector. Kathy Stevenson, you cover food, and immigration is a huge issue. As Matt reported in his story, Randy Parker from the Utah Farm Bureau was in Washington. I mean, what does immigration reform mean for the agricultural sector?
I think it's agriculture. I think it's restaurants, they're the employees that they need to build their business, and without them, they struggle. The farmers struggle. How are they going to get their crops? I mean, we've heard reports from other states, not really Utah, where, they have to let the crops die in the field because there's nobody to pick them.
Hmm.
You know, that's tragic. if you're a farmer, you've just, declared bankruptcy if you can't pick your crop. So this is really a business issue, and I think maybe that maybe is why some of the leaders in Utah see it as a business issue. You've got to have employees, you've got to have workers to, to bring in the crops or serve the meals or, whatever.
Hmm. Matt, the legislation has changed over and over again, even though there's an urgency from many groups. You say Washington is a little reluctant for a number of factors. You mentioned Jason Chaffetz. How does the rest of the Utah delegation look at the immigration issue?
Here's the breakdown. We'll start with the Senate, where action's already taken place. Senator Mike Lee is with Jason Chaffetz. He's against the bill that the Senate passed. It is wary of what the House is working on. He looks at this as a party split, where Democrats are trying to get a path of legal status and eventual citizenship to the 12 million undocumented immigrants. And I would point out that the majority of people of this descent are Hispanic, and they have tended to vote Democrat in recent elections. So you can see some reluctance electorally from Republicans. You have someone like Senator Orrin Hatch, who has actually voted for this, the Senate bill the first time in his lengthy Senate career, where he has endorsed a path to citizenship. And he's taking this business angle, saying this is an issue that is enough is enough. We need to get some certainty. We need to help the economy. It's right for the people who have been in the shadows in our society for a long time.
Hmm.
On the House side, as I said, Jason Chaffetz is against this. Representative Chris Stewart, our freshman, is against this. Then you have Rob Bishop and Jim Matheson, who have also who have not supported what's going on but are not as strong on it. They haven't used the same strident language that you hear from a representative, Jason Chaffetz, claiming this is amnesty. but they haven't endorsed anything either. I think they're people a little bit in the middle here. I think what we've seen is this push by the business community has had impact. You've seen Republicans change their language. But when it comes down to it, politicians respond to electoral concerns. And there is a large group of activists in our community who do not like the idea of a path to citizenship for someone who got here around the U.S. laws, not through the U.S. laws. Mm. And that contingent still plays big in the Republican politics. It's the split that's quite interesting that we're seeing playing out in Utah and nationally.
I understand that President Obama is urging Congress to pass immigration overhaul by year's end. That seems very ambitious for a man who's sort of embattled with his own health care reform issues. Paul Rawley, any chance? Realistic or a pipe dream?
Oh, that's a pipe dream. You know, they're not going to do anything before the end of the year. I mean, Congress is... they've shown how belligerent they are toward the president, and they're not going to give him any kind of victory like that. They're still looking at 2014, and they've made it very clear the Republicans in Congress they want him to fail, and they don't want to give him any victories. So that's a pipe dream. That won't happen at all.
If you're just joining us, you're tuning into the premiere broadcast of a new program here on KCPW called Utah Week in Review. Again, a way to process what's happening in the world and locally especially. We're here joined with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Rawley, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Kathy Stevenson, and our Washington correspondent Matt Kadam. And of course, you're invited to join this conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can put your thoughts in the comment section at sltrib.com. You can also send questions and comments to UT Review on Twitter and Google Plus. Brevity is all about Twitter, right? Let's move on to liquor. Yay. Liquor. Kathy Stevenson, you cover this beat for the Trib. This week, the State Liquor Commission sort of hit the reset button on guidelines over how, when, and who can get drinks in a restaurant. In a nutshell, what are the new guidelines?
Basically, the DABC Liquor Commission decided to create some guidelines to guide restaurants in meeting the state's intent to dine law. This is a law that's been on the books for a long time, but earlier this year, the legislature wanted to clarify and tweak it. HB 240 was the bill. And they wanted to make sure that customers showed intent to dine. They just wanted to make sure people knew they had to have food. So
you have to eat something if you're going
to
drink
something. Yes.
Okay.
And basically, they said, they could create all these rules, but they decided just to have guidelines and say, listen, the restaurants have to make some sort of effort to find out if you're going to dine. So the easiest way to do that is just to ask, are you going to dine with us tonight? It seems obvious, I think, to a lot of people because, hey, I'm in a restaurant. Of course I want food. But I think they just really wanted to clarify, you can't just assume things. So
are they beefing up enforcement in addition to just these new
rules? The State Bureau of Investigation are the ones that go around and enforce these laws. And they have, in recent years, hired new, detectives might be the right word. I'm not sure. But there are more enforcement officers out there going around. I think it's pretty clear to the restaurants that when those enforcement officers come in, they sit down and say, I don't want food. I want a drink. So, the employees have to really be trained to know, you can't do that. I'm sorry. Mm. I think 99.9% of people who go into a restaurant order food. I think it's pretty clear. I think they're just trying to get that smaller percentage to understand. And maybe these are visitors from out of state who don't understand the state law.
Yeah. Paul Rawley, put this in some context for us. This is an issue that came up months ago after the DABC issued some warnings or citations on some restaurants who were not complying with the rules.
Well, they got a new director several months ago, and one of the first things he did was he sent out a memo basically saying that people had to actually order food from the menu before they could have a drink, which caused all sorts of. I mean, that hasn't been the way it was before. There's always been that rule that you had to eat and you had to show intent to eat. But this caused problems for the restaurants because, you know how it works. You go in and they'll ask if you want something to drink. You order a glass of wine while you're looking over the menu. You also, a lot of times, a lot of restaurants have a waiting area. They're all tables are full and you can have a glass of wine. And then all of a sudden, they're telling the restaurants that you actually had to order from the menu before you could eat, which caused a lot of problems. And it was an internal memo, and it leaked out, and the Tribune ran stories, and then it became very controversial, and that's what led now to clarification from the legislature, and now this clarification from the board. But over the years, some of these undercover vice people who would go in to look for violations got very aggressive, they would harangue waitresses or waiters. And in fact, there was one case where a waitress finally got so worn down by their insistence that they have a beer before they order and that sort of thing. She said, look, I'll bring you, I can't remember what it was exactly, an English muffin or some kind of appetizer. And she said, I'll pay for it. Well, then they busted her because
it can't be free food
right.
And you buy the drink.
Yeah, right.
It has to be
they have
you
to,
do them
yeah,
both.
Right, they have to. But they have kind of backed off. I mean, there were some egregious stories of undercover guys going in and sexually harassing a waitress because they thought that helped them fit into, the bar environment because they obviously don't understand. I mean, anybody who does that gets thrown out by the bouncer.
Sure.
They didn't know that. But I think they've backed off. There are also some new commissioners who are very reasonable people and not as strife. For a long time, there were. It was just a few years ago when the commission had somebody on the commission who actually was a social drinker. They were, for years and years and years, forever, they were teetotalers, all of them. And so they didn't really understand the environment. But now you've got a couple of social drinkers, plus you've got people like John T. Nielsen and Dennis Nordfeldt, who are very, have a long history in several areas of government, and they understand, they bring up an understanding that maybe wasn't there before.
Mm. Kathy, so how are restaurant owners reacting? How's the public reacting to these new guidelines?
Oh, I think from the comment board on my story earlier, I think people think they're a little bit extreme, like, really? Come on, I'm going to a restaurant. Of course I'm going to eat, but I don't think it's unfair, really, to just ask. I mean, I think I've been asked, for years, and I always thought it was maybe a little strange. Are you going to dine with us tonight? Yes. But, just asking and making sure, if that shows intent, I think we can all kind of live with that.
But the restaurant sector, they're okay with it?
I think so, too. I think they were really looking to the commission for the guidelines because I don't, like Paul said, they didn't want to be caught with a fine. Those fines are expensive. They're thousands of dollars. So I think they wanted guidance from the Liquor Commission, and so this kind of settles it. You've got to make an effort. And, so the good ones will.
Okay, so we're November 1st. The session starts in a couple of months. Are we done with liquor for a while, Paul Raleigh?
Oh, we'll never be done with liquor. It's interesting. For decades, the legislature has struggled with this. First of all, they get a lot of influence from the LDS Church on liquor legislation. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a liquor bill ever passed without the church giving an okay, a tacit okay. The church understands that this is a big economic development issue as well, and so they're always trying to find a balance. But I think what really kind of threw this into high gear was John Huntsman, when he was governor several years ago, he pushed through legislation that was monumental. It did away with the private club private clubs that we'd had for years, where, because it was a pretty ridiculous system. People, tourists would come in, or, I mean, you could buy a club pass, but you had a system where every time you, you know, went to a different bar or something, you had to buy a temporary license for $5, and people coming from out of state thought that was pretty ridiculous. And as an economic development tool, they did away with the private clubs, and now, but at the same time, the people who are very concerned about drinking and alcohol and the effects of that, you know, drunk driving or underage drinking and that sort of thing, got very, very nervous, and we're talking about people in the legislature about this pretty, in Utah, radical change. And so they've been kind of pushing back ever since, and making a little more difficult, like the Zion Curtain, for example, where you have to have a some kind of
a barrier,
obstruction between, so you can't see people mixing drinks and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's pushback. You know, the House actually passed a bill that would do away with the Zion Curtain, but the Senate, I don't think it ever even saw the light of day in the Senate. Michael Wadup, the president of the Senate, who's now gone and on a mission, was very, very strident against any kind of anything that would make it easier to get a drink. Now John Valentine is kind of the conduit with the church, and he's the guy who pretty much does all the liquor legislation in the Senate, and he's a pretty reasonable guy, but he's also very cognizant of the concerns by the church and others. MAD, for example, they have a big seat at the table.
Mothers against drunk driving.
Well,
so, clearly we're not. It'll be around, Kathy. You'll be around to cover it. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Kathy Stevenson also with us. Political columnist Paul Raleigh and Matt Canham joining us from Washington. You're listening to Utah Week in Review, your place for a news recap of what's happening in Utah this week. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or go to the comment section at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Utah Week in Review. I'm your host, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, here with Salt Lake Tribune political columnist Paul Raleigh, a reporter Kathy Stevenson, and Washington correspondent Matt Canham. We're taking your thoughts on the top stories of the week, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, or go to UT Review on Twitter and Google Plus. Let's move over to John Swallow. A story by Trib government reporter Robert Gerke says that investigators looking into the behavior of Swallow claim that some documents were missing. Paul Raleigh, what was missing?
Well, internal electronic documents, communications, emails, that sort of thing. There was a story today saying that the attorney for John Swallow said that was a mistake. They were mistakenly erased because they got a new computer system or a new system.
It went from GroupWise to Google.
Yeah, and they inadvertently got erased. So, politically, that's going to be kind of a charged thing. But, what are you going to do? You can't prove that they weren't mistakenly erased, and now the investigators don't know what's on those. There is some effort, and there is capability in some instances to go back and retrieve things that were erased. That was done, actually. There was when I wrote about this a while ago, but when there was an initiative petition going around, and the issue was electronic signatures, to get certain things on the ballot that the legislature didn't want,
mm-hmm.
Redistricting thing, an ethics commission, and that sort of thing. And all of a sudden, it comes out that Christine Durham—I mean, this thing had gone to the Supreme Court. Christine Durham, a Supreme Court justice, had signed the petition. Well, it turned out she didn't sign the petition. Somebody forged her name.
Mm.
And so they did an investigation, and they traced it back to a computer in the House of Representatives. So somebody at a computer in the House of Representatives actually forged her name, and then made it an issue that she'd have to recuse herself, and also show that how electronic signatures are bad because they can be manipulated and that sort of thing. And they were actually able to. That had been erased. Also, but they were able to take that computer, they were able to trace it to a computer and then take that computer and retrieve what was on there to be able to identify which computer it was done. And that investigation is still going on.
Mm. Matt Canham, you have, I'm sure, filed many government's records request. I mean, I find myself deleting files and emails all the time. What are government officials required to save, Matt?
So a lot of their emails, they can just get rid of. I mean, we get so many in a day.
Sure.
But what makes this one kind of interesting is that this has been a probe into the new Attorney General for quite some time. And there was only a request sent out to the Attorney General's staff on September 30th to not delete any records. In a case like this, when you know that there's an investigation underway, you have a legal responsibility not to destroy evidence. And that's why this is a big issue. The FBI has been investigating the Attorney General for months, and so he's known it. And if they can recover any of these emails, there's a possibility that he could get a charge for obstructing justice and an investigation. Now, as Paul pointed out, that's going to be kind of hard to prove, but it's not impossible to prove. The FBI, the Justice Department, has decided not to charge John Swallow with a crime, but the FBI is still working with Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill and the Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings to see if the Attorney General violated any state laws. So this issue is not done.
Momentum on the legislative investigative committee. Paul Raleigh, does this give them something more to talk about when they meet in committee next week?
Oh, absolutely. This will give them a lot. There's a lot of things going on politically, I believe. Becky Lockhart is, I believe, and a lot of others believe, is going to run for governor in 2016. And she's, the Speaker of the House while they're doing this probe on possible impeachment. And so she's going to be really in the limelight here. And she's going to have to make sure that everything she does is professional, it can't be second-guessed, because that could come back to bite her when, as I believe, she runs for governor in 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you mentioned that justice is no longer investigating. The Utah Bar dismissed a couple of complaints, but there's still a significant interest from the FBI, Salt Lake County, and Davis County. How effective can Swallow be when he's under the microscope like this?
Well, I think you've seen our former Attorney General, Mark Shurtleff, was much more of a public figure in his office than John Swallow has been. Because of these investigations, Swallow has been rather isolated. People don't want to have him at their events because there's a perception of possible impropriety. Now, it's really hard on a radio program to point out how this controversy is unfolded, because there's been so many twists and turns.
Mm.
But what it comes down to is that Attorney General John Swallow has been accused of helping a person who is under potential federal investigation to gain undue access to a member of Congress. He's accused of extorting a person who is under investigation by the Attorney General's office. there's a lot of accusations out there. We should point out he's said that he's done nothing wrong and that the Attorney General has not been charged with anything yet. But there has been so much smoke that the state legislature felt the need to start this investigation to see if maybe there should be an impeachment proceeding. Mm-hmm. The interesting part is that the state legislative investigation has allowed us to peek behind the curtain a little bit more than we were when it was just the FBI investigation or just the local investigation conducted by Gill and Rawlings. And we'll see as this goes on. We have some great reporters who are on top of this issue.
And the Salt Lake Tribune, of course, broke this story just days after Swallow was installed as Utah Attorney General. As you mentioned, the journalists at the Trib are not going to let this story go. We'll continue to report on it. And you can find full coverage at sltrib.com. Again, you're listening to Utah Week in Review, a new show where you can think about the week's news and chime in on the week's news. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK. Also, put comments in the comment section at sltrib.com or send your tweets to UT Review on Twitter and Google+. Back to the liquor issue. I don't know who this tweet is from, but asking diners joining us for dinner is no big deal. The Zion Curtain is the economic issue. Restaurant groups are not coming to Utah. This is from the virtual SOM, I guess. So Kathy Stevenson, economics is really a factor in this whole issue.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Zion Curtain keeps, you know, maybe some national chains. Well, and local businesses, that's expensive to have to do that. Also, I think we didn't kind of really talk about the club licenses. I mean, there are businesses that have been waiting to have a club license, and I think it's going on 3 years for some of them because there just aren't club licenses. So the liquor laws do kind of stifle new business, and that means employment and taxes, and, you know, it's kind of this ripple effect. So definitely the liquor laws affect our economic development.
Again, send your tweets to UT Review on Google Plus and on Twitter, or call us 801-355-TALK. Let's move to the more salacious things in town. We've had a very dramatic murder trial happening in Provo. It's gaining a lot of attention both locally and nationally. Nancy Grace has a fascination with it. Kathy, bring us up to speed on all the gory details of this courtroom drama surrounding Martin McNeil.
Well, this is an intriguing, intense mystery that could be a Hollywood movie, right?
It probably will be, right?
it's happening in a Utah courtroom. You know, it has all the elements, you know, beauty queen wife, doctor husband, money, drugs, another woman named Gypsy. I mean, it's just got everything. Children testifying against their father. I mean, it's really got everything. But really, on its surface, it's a tragic story. You know, children are without their mother. You know, children testifying against their father. I've been kind of, you know, infatuated with the story, really, just watching it and trying to understand. You know, I go back and forth between, oh, he did it, he didn't do it, I don't know. You know, it's hard.
I don't think you're alone in that. The highlights this week, his daughters took the stand.
Daughters,
what did they
took
say?
The stand. Daughters took the stand. You know, knowing that they talked to their mother before she died, and she had told them, I'm worried, I think he's having an affair, you know, be careful. I think that's very telling if she's confiding in her daughters before anything really even happened. So they testified against their father for that. Very emotional when he brought in Gypsy Willis and said she was a nanny. The daughter, you know, kind of confronted the father, you know, said absolutely not. I know about her. I know, the daughter said that, you know, she wasn't a nanny. She didn't cook. She didn't take care of the younger siblings. So some really damaging testimony, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, in addition to all the intrigue of this particular case, I mean, this is Utah's first televised trial. Paul, what kind of viewership are we getting? And how is this affecting the lawyering, the judge in this case? I mean, what is having the camera in the courtroom mean?
Well, yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on the judge and the attorneys. I mean, you might remember the O.J. Simpson trial, it seemed to me that the attorneys were playing more to the camera oftentimes, and
they became celebrities.
And so that was a big distraction, and played. Got the Judge Ito a lot of criticism for losing control of the trial, and of course he was kind of playing to the camera too. It was like everybody wanted to be, you know, on TV, and do their, you know, acting or whatever. And so it's got to put a lot of pressure. From what I've been able to see, at least, you know, reading the stories and how it's progressing, I think this judge has done a pretty good job of you know, keeping the trial going in a professional way. You know, I have no idea how it's going to turn out. It's like Kathy said, it's people like Nancy Grace and people like that, they love this stuff, you know. It's to me, I've always been a little disgusted at our appetite for these kinds of stories, but you know, they get a lot of attention, they get a lot of readership, and the fact that this is being televised has you know, now got national attention because of, like, what Kathy pointed out are all the salacious details in the story.
Well, we've been streaming the video live at sltrib.com. Are we going to see more of this, Kathy? What are your thoughts? Do you think this is setting a precedent for high-profile cases here in Utah?
I do. I think, you know, just the way our society is now, we post things on Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, people just have a demand for that kind of information. So I see it. I see it happening again. I hope there are some restrictions, though. You know, you don't want to compromise somebody's right to a fair trial just because people have an appetite for that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some sort of balance. But I see the push for it. So, you know, the judicial system might give in a little bit more.
Speaking with Trib reporter Kathy Stevenson, columnist Paul Raleigh, and Matt Canham from Washington. Again, this is Utah Week in Review, a place where you can process the week's news. And I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. We need to take another really quick break, but we'll be right back. Welcome back to Utah Week in Review. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune, and we are talking about the week's top stories with Paul Raleigh, a political columnist, also with reporter Kathy Stevenson and Washington correspondent Matt Canham. And we invite you to join us as well, of course. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Also send your tweets to the hashtag UTReview on Twitter and Google+. Also put your comments in the comment section at sltrib.com. Let's go to the phones, and it looks like Alan is joining us from Salt Lake City. Alan, hi.
Yes, I've been a bartender in Salt Lake City now for about 20 years. And our liquor laws are so seriously embarrassing. I think the legislation should have to actually enforce their laws like I do and feel how embarrassing it actually is.
What do you mean that the legislation should have to enforce? What do you mean by that?
Well, isn't it illegal to for the separation of church and state? It's just embarrassing.
Alan, thanks so much for the call.
I'm so fed up, I can't even speak right now. I'm sorry.
I think we got your message loud and clear, Alan. Thanks a lot. Kathy, an embarrassment?
Oh, you know, it's always rough. I mean, the legislature makes the laws, and then they hand it off to the Liquor Commission, who has to kind of set up the rules. And then there's another step, and there's actual real people who have to implement them. And so in that process, there might be a little bit of we make the rules, but in practice, it's hard to put them in play. I do feel like I've talked to food writers all around the country, and we are not the only state with crazy liquor laws. You know, everybody's got dry counties, or you can't buy things on Sunday. So I think there's lots of states that have issues. Utah's might rank up there higher than others, but you know, the Zion Curtain might be that. But yeah, I think there is a disconnect between, you know, a law's made and then trying to implement it at a restaurant level. It's tough for them.
Alan, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's turn to Mike Lee. In Texas, Senator Ted Cruz got a hero's welcome for his role in the recent government shutdown. Senator Lee, of course, played a prominent role in the shutdown. He's holding a rally tomorrow in South Jordan. Matt Cannon, what kind of reception is he going to get?
I would assume it will be overwhelmingly positive. I will say this. The Tea Party supporters that Senator Mike Lee has are remarkably enthusiastic and willing to come out and show it. He held a series of town hall meetings in the middle of this fight to defund Obamacare, which did not work. These town halls happen in more rural areas of the state. I attended one when I was in Utah in Pleasant Grove. So many people showed up that they had to move it to a larger building, and the attendees had to help set up the folding chairs. And there I found, of a group of hundreds, I found three that I could identify were not supporters of them. One of them spoke and actually said something quite complimentary. So Mike Lee has a strong base of support. What should make this thing interesting is that the Utah Democratic Party is also trying to get people to come to this event, because they're frustrated that none of those town halls I just mentioned happen in the major population hubs of the state. So there could be a clash of different groups that we'll see on Saturday.
It's interesting. I mean, the Democrats in the state, of course, have been bashing him. But he's also gotten a fair bit of criticism from moderate Republicans here, Paul. So even though he may get this rousing reception, it's not uniformly across the GOP, right?
Well, Senator Orrin Hatch, the senior senator, actually said publicly that Mike Lee now needs to get rehabilitated over the next 3 years. So, I mean, he was pretty forceful in saying that Senator Lee made a mistake with, you know, the way he handled all this, and the Republican Party has taken a hit.
Is the rally to change the narrative?
Well, I don't. I mean, Matt touched on this, but I don't think it's a coincidence that he's having the rally in South Jordan, where if you look at the Utah legislature, I mean, some of the most Tea Party right-wing people come from that area of the county, that southwest area. And so by going to South Jordan, I said in my column it's the Utah equivalent of going on Fox News. You know, he's going to surround himself just like he did with the town halls. He didn't hold one town hall in Salt Lake County, which is more of a swing county. He held them all in very, very Republican, safe areas where he knew he'd get a positive response. And I think the idea in South Jordan is to get a big ovation and have it on the news and have TV cameras showing this big standing ovation he's getting from his fans in these very right-wing Tea Party areas.
Hmm. Kathy, I understand you're going to be covering this event. What are you looking for?
I think I'm going to be looking for people who, you know, why they came out. Why are you still supporting Lee? You know, he's, I don't want to say he's given the GOP a black eye, but, you know, people kind of go, what are you doing? You represent all of Utah. So I'll be looking for people why they still support him and why they kind of want to keep him in the forefront.
Mm. And Matt, you've reported that Senator Lee is not apologetic at all about his recent actions. I mean, in fact, he's embracing his heightened role in the national conversation over the Tea Party, right?
Right. He's telling people who are frustrated with him that he's doing exactly what he told them he was going to do. And we've seen in recent politics that authenticity and keeping your word has been important. So he's a little befuddled why so many people are surprised by the actions he's taken. Mike Lee is one of the most conservative, if not the most conservative member of the United States Senate. So you can't expect him to play the deal maker role. That's not what he ever presented himself as. And what we're seeing here is something similar than what we're seeing on the immigration issue, is that there is a split within the Republican Party among the more business-oriented, some might say moderates, but a lot of Republicans would bristle at that term, establishment group of Republicans and the activist Tea Party group of Republicans. And this, you know, isn't surprising after the Republican Party lost the presidential election that there's some infighting about the path forward. And I think we're seeing that play out in Utah. The microcosm is fascinating. The Orrin Hatch wing and the Mike Lee wing of the party is at odds with each other. And that is the major political story in this country going forward.
Speaking of politics, next Tuesday, it's election day. It's kind of an understated election day, right? I mean, Raleigh, you've been writing a lot about the partisanship that seems to be seeping into nonpartisan races at the city level, the local level. What's going on?
Well, there's always been a partisan element to the nonpartisan municipal elections. In Salt Lake City, it's well-known fact that if you're a Republican, you're never going to get elected mayor. The last Republican who was mayor in Salt Lake City was back in the early 70s, Conrad Harrison.
It's a while ago.
So it's always there, and Democrats will, who identify as Democrats will vote for the Democrat, and Republicans will vote for the Republicans. Republicans in Salt Lake City have the minority, which is an interesting thing given the, how conservative the state of Utah is. A few years ago, you had two Democrats running. You had Frank Pignanelli ran against a very liberal Democrat, Rocky Anderson, and you had Republicans rallying behind Pignanelli and actually helping him on his campaign. What has ratcheted it up this year is the Salt Lake County chair, Chad Bennion, actually put on the website who the Republicans are, and then in Holiday, the Republicans have been, I mean, all of a sudden you have this direct mail campaign now, and they've made it very, very partisan, and having Republicans and identifying themselves as different officers in the Republican Party who are basically rallying behind a certain candidate for mayor. And, you know, when these people have had debates, these two mayoral candidates, there's not a lot of difference between them in terms of their vision for the city. But the one difference is the one guy's calling himself a Republican, as though, you know, that should be the issue. In fact, one partisan supporter of him said that in Holiday, you know, the representatives in the legislature in Holiday are all Democrats, so they need to have a Republican for balance, as though it gets away from the reason that municipal elections are nonpartisan in the first place, and that is that, you know, paving roads and building curbs and gutters and policing, you know, shouldn't be political. They're not political. You know, a curb is not a Republican or a Democrat. But this year, it seems more than usual, you've seen this real partisanship getting into. It's almost like the Republicans aren't satisfied, you know, holding just about every partisan office. Now they want to get into all the little city offices as well and control everything.
That's Paul Raleigh on municipal elections. We're going to have to leave it there for this week. Paul Raleigh, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Kathy Stevenson, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Matt Canham from Washington. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune humor columnist Robert Kirby. He's been writing for the Trib since 1994, often observing the quirks of Mormon culture, as only a faithful member of the LDS Church can. For the past week, he's been flooded with feedback about his recent column petitioning to become a Relief Society president. That's a leader in the all-women's branch of the LDS Church. And it's not the first time that Kirby has ventured across the religion's gender divide.
It was back in, I think, 2008, and I'd just fed up with high priest group meeting, which is, you know, you have priesthood meeting while the women are having their Relief Society meeting, and I'd just been through a lesson that made me want to get on a roof with a rifle, and so I just chucked it and went to Relief Society.
How'd that go?
They're pretty nervous at first. They come in there. Not only is it a guy, but it's this guy, you know. We could all end up in the paper. And so they're really nervous. And as the seating took place, there was this huge area around me where no one sat. And they really couldn't quite figure that out. And the bishop's wife came up and said, "What are you doing in here?" I said, "I'm just changing it up a little bit. I want to see how the other half lives."
And this was fodder for a column that you wrote.
I just spun it into a column of the difference between priesthood meeting and relief society. And it actually worked out that I'd rather be in a relief society.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. This is a column from 2008, Robert Kirby from the Salt Lake Tribune.
Thanks to folding chairs, I come out of high priests when I do go, numb at both ends. Relief Society is the only classroom in a Mormon church where the chairs are padded. It smells better. High priest smells like Preparation H and dry scalp. But I'll bet half of any blessings I got coming that someone in Relief Society was wearing white shoulders. The music is angelic. It helps that Relief Society had someone who played the piano. But it wouldn't matter if we had a band. Priesthood bearers in the Rosecrest First Ward sing like oxen held at gunpoint. The lesson was clearly prepared. By this I mean that some thought went into it. The teacher stayed on track, and no one, not even once, drew a corollary between the gospel of Jesus Christ and the NFL.
Now, the immediate reaction to this column was mixed.
Yeah, it was. Well, it's typically mixed, but in this particular case, it was evenly mixed. There were, you know, of the response, half thought I was going to hell tomorrow, and the other half, you know, enjoyed it because they had similar thoughts themselves, and it was nice to see it in print. And but it had some legs to it because the response was coming back for a couple of weeks, and the longer it went, the more upset people seemed to get. And then about 2 or 3 months out, it just stopped all of a sudden. And it shifted back to where I was getting dozens of emails from people who thought this was really great. And I didn't really understand why that happened until someone told me that Chieko Okazaki, who was one of the counselors in the Relief Society presidency at the time for the entire church, had read it in a women's conference, which totally floored me.
So at that point, it was legitimized. It was okay to laugh at yourself.
Right, yes. People whose lives are governed by a very strict hierarchy often need that permission to be able to, oh, okay, this is funny then. And the truth is, I'm not after the doctrine or what's sacred. I'm after their behavior. And this is like writing about my own family. You got to be a little careful, but they're crazy.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Again, hear him unplugged each week here on Utah Week in Review and his columns at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Utah Week in Review, the show produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks so much for tuning in. See you next week.